It's 4 hours Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
Libyan government tries to halt oil exports by an armed militia group. Sudanese refugees caught up in South Sudan fighting. I'm Victor Beatty reporting from Washington. Libyan Navy and pro-government militia have dispatched boats to a port held by a rival militia to stop a North Korean-flagged tanker from exporting oil sold without government permission. The government has banned militia from selling crude directly to the world market. A spokesman for Libya's Ministry of Culture and Government, Abib El-Amin, said orders were given and all efforts undertaken to stop and seize the tanker, if necessary, by a strike if it does not follow orders. Libya's Prime Minister Ali Zidane threatened to bomb the tanker if it doesn't comply with government orders. He said the bombing would result in an environmental disaster. Armed gunmen forced workers loyal to the government to dock the vessel on Saturday. A militia spokesman warned the government not to intervene. Analysts say the military would probably struggle to overcome rebels battle-hardened in the uprising to topple dictator Muammar Gaddafi in 2011. The rebels have kept their weapons and now challenge state authority. The UN Refugee Agency has warned that tens of thousands of Sudanese refugees in neighboring South Sudan face a severe food shortage. Lisa Schlein reports some 130,000 from Sudan's embattled Blue Nile State are living in camps in Upper Nile State in South Sudan, directly affected by ethnic fighting there.
UNHCR spokesman Adrian Edwards says insecurity and border restrictions along supply corridors have prevented the delivery of relief items since the beginning of the year. He tells VOA it is urgent to get food into the refugee camps before the onset of the rains, which will render roads impassable.
It has been impossible to get food prepositioned there because of the insecurity we've seen, and this now is starting to show itself in some very worrying consequences. Real shortages of food, glowing rates of global and severe acute malnutrition.
Edward says about one-third of the refugee population is at greatest risk. It includes children under five, pregnant and lactating women, elderly, the disabled, and those who are chronically ill. The World Food Program has been providing normal food rations for the refugee camps, but the agency says the crisis in South Sudan is making it extremely difficult to access this region and resupply the camps. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The International Criminal Court Friday convicted former Congolese warlord Germaine Katanga of being an accessory to crimes against humanity, although he was cleared of more serious charges allegedly carried out in 2003. Henry Ridgewell has the story on the trial that lasted 6 years.
The conviction marks only a partial victory for the prosecution, says Phil Clark, an expert on the ICC from London's School of Oriental and African Studies.
The more important charges around whether Katanga orchestrated these massacres in Ituri province in northeastern Congo, whether he was responsible for rape, sexual slavery and the use of child soldiers, that they'll be disappointed that those charges didn't stick.
Katanga led a militia group called the Patriotic Resistance Force in Ituri, a diamond-rich part of northeast Congo. In one attack in February 2003, prosecutors said at least 200 civilians died as Katanga directed child soldiers in a killing spree. Women and girls were allegedly forced to become sex slaves. Katanga was found guilty of supplying guns in the massacre, but not of directing it. Legal observers say Germaine Katanga's defence team is likely to appeal his guilty verdict. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
The French press agency, quoting officials, reports African peacekeepers in Somalia, coordinating with government forces, have recaptured several strategic towns in the southwest from Al-Qaeda-linked Al-Shabaab militants. AMISOM announced a wide-scale offensive Thursday against Islamists located near the Ethiopian border. Reuters reports more than a dozen members of a Burundian opposition party were injured in clashes with police late Saturday. Others were arrested. The clashes occurred at the headquarters of the MSD party, a member of the Alliance for Democratic Change coalition. The UN Human Rights Commission has expressed its concern at increasing restrictions on civil and political rights in Burundi following a series of violent actions by the ruling party's youth wing and police, including the disruption of public meetings organized by opposition parties. Burundi is to hold elections next year. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News. You can read more by accessing our internet website at voanews.com.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington.
And I'm Odette Frazier. Today's Monday, March 10th. And here are some of the stories we are covering. Sudan denies supporting rebels in renewed Darfur violence.
It is the rebels who now they are robbing and killing and actually making some sort of actually revenge and retaliation. It is not the government at all.
Achmed Bilal is Sudan's Minister of Information. The Sudan government has also denied civil society allegations that it denied permits for an International Women's Day rally. The Nigerian government says former head of state Abacha's confiscated money will be used for infrastructure development, and Uganda's police say they do not prevent opposition rallies.
What I know, the Uganda police force is nationalistic, patriotic, professional, disciplined, competent, and we are productive.
Patrick Onyango is Deputy Uganda Police Spokesman. We'll conclude our series on Africa and the Chinese Dream, and we'll tell you about a new report on Sierra Leone's governance, education, and justice sectors.
Those stories plus Mark Oldman's sports and our listener of the day are all coming up on Daybreak Africa. Sudan's Minister of Information says the United States is hurting the people of Sudan more than anybody else by continuing to impose sanctions on the government in Khartoum. Achmed Bilal says Sudan is currently enjoying what he calls a conducive environment of national dialogue that will eventually lead to a consensus to peacefully transfer power through a fair and transparent election. Minister Bilal was reacting to a U.S. government call on the Sudanese government to prevent further acts of violence by government-supported fighters in Darfur. State Department spokeswoman Jen Psaki issued a statement over the weekend condemning what she called the Sudan government's campaign of aerial bombardment. But Information Minister Bilal tells me it is the rebels who are responsible for the renewed violence in Darfur and not the Sudanese government.
On the contrary, actually, if I hear that the United States is calling the rebels to stop attacking the innocent citizens, because in the last few days, many attacks have been happened by the rebels on the innocent citizens. It's not the government. It is the rebels who now they are robbing and killing and actually making some sort of actually revenge and retaliation. It is not the government at all.
I think the State Department is saying that your government supports the rebels, so it assumes that you are encouraging the violence.
How could we support the rebels? When we fight the rebels and we do some actually sort of attack against them, then everybody talk about human rights and the genocide and killing. When the rebels do the contrary and they kill the people, they say the governments are supporting them or making this for them possible. It is not at all. This is illogical. We are actually now in the whole Sudan, we are calling for peace. We are calling for national dialogue and debate. How to make a roadmap to solve our problems. How to reach a consensus by which we can transfer the power peacefully to others and to do an fair and transparent elections. This is now the talk in Sudan, which we need support from the international, you know, society about this, not the contrary.
Mr. Minister, the United States is accusing your government of carrying out air attacks, bombings in Darfur. Would you be willing to let UN peacekeepers to investigate the incidents?
The UN, they are there in Darfur, and they can investigate this, but we will not accept the expect from the American government to say otherwise. Every time that we are doing something, they are telling the contrary. In this, you know, conducive environment of the dialogue and the debate, they are actually making the sanctions and they are making it more tight against the people of Sudan and not the government for the transference and the remittance of any sort of money out to Sudan or outside of Sudan. This is what the government of the American government is doing. The American government is harming our people more than anybody else. It's not our government.
Achmed Bilal is Sudan's Minister of Information. He spoke with me from the capital, Khartoum.
The Khartoum government is also denying claims by civil society and women's groups that it denied permission to Sudanese women to hold an International Women's Day event over the weekend. Information Minister Ahmed Bilal says a small group of women failed to get permission from authorities to hold their rally. He tells James Batty Sudanese women enjoy more freedom than in any other country.
It's not actually. This is a group, a small group, and they have actually to take a permission in one of the clubs, and they didn't make the permission. You know, the women's rights in Sudan is far advanced than any country else. We have in our constitution 25% representation of women in the parliament, in the executive government, in everywhere. We have no problem with women. In fact, what happened, only this small group asked to make their festival in a club, and they didn't take a permission. This is what happened.
Hamed Bilal is Sudan's Minister of Information. He spoke with James Batty from the capital, Khartoum. Al-Bakir Mukhtar is founder of the Al-Khatim Adlan Center for Enlightenment and Human Development, also known as CASE, a non-governmental and non-profit organization in Khartoum. He says his group was one of 30 organizations that was prevented from by the government to hold International Women's Day rally.
The government is not telling us why, but this is the norm here in Sudan. The security forces, they don't allow any activities by the civil society. The independent civil society is being restricted severely by the government. In 2012, four local organizations have been closed down by the government. My organization was one of these four organizations that is being closed down. The rest of the organizations, the independent civil society organizations that are not closed down, are severely restricted to do anything. So the space for freedoms is shrinking rapidly since the separation of the South until now.
The Minister of Information, Ahmed Bilal, said that Sudanese women can do whatever they like to do.
This is nonsense. Everybody knows now in Sudan that the government is increasingly becoming or acting in a very intolerant way. It simply stopped an activity. People are really surprised what harm would do the government or would happen to the government if such a celebration take place. So what the officials say is something that they know is wrong, they know is not correct.
Al-Bakir Mukhtar is founder of the Al-Khatim Adlan Center for Enlightenment and Human Development. He was speaking with James Batty from Khartoum.
A Uganda police spokesman says senior government officials did not deny permits for opposition meetings. Deputy police spokesman Patrick Onyango also rejects criticism that the police used violence to crush demonstrators who were demanding better living conditions. Onyango's comments come after opposition groups and human rights organizations urged President Yoweri Museveni to stop cabinet officials from dragging the police into politics. Onyango tells reporter Peter Clotty the police are professionals who are simply carrying out their constitutional mandate to enforce the country's laws irrespective of party affiliation.
Country, there are laws, and we are the enforcers of the law. Definitely, someone who is always on the wrong side of the law cannot say nice things about the law enforcers. So the oppositions are entitled to their opinion, but what I know, the Uganda police force is nationalistic, patriotic, professional, disciplined, competent, and we are productive. So let the opposition follow the law and obey the law. And we see how they will say that we are now involved in politics. It is always that they want to be on the wrong side of the law.
What do you say to people who say that the police being used by politicians in the ruling party to prevent the opposition from gathering and from expressing their opinion on matters of national importance?
There is no anybody from the ruling party that has directed police or influenced police that do this and this. What we do, we are following the law. And we have been asking the opposition that please do follow the law as it is required. And that is all. The ruling movement does not have any influence on the Uganda police force. What we do is professionally in line with our mandate as the Constitution gives us the mandate.
They said usually the police administration often refuses to grant them permit for their rallies. When they try to hold rallies in the capital, Kampala, the police find all kinds of excuses not to grant them permit. What is your reaction to that?
Our reaction to that is normally when they request or notify us that they are going to hold the rally, they normally intend to hold their rally in business centers, places where the transaction going on. They intend to go where the people are already there. They don't want to go and mobilize. We normally tell them that please go to specific fields, maybe playgrounds of primary schools or any secondary school, but that they normally don't want to accept that.
They also say sometimes the police also use unnecessary violent tactics to suppress their meetings and rallies and all that. Do you care to comment?
We normally use force which is proportionate to the force against us. So when they use force, we also use an extra force.
Patrick Onyango is Deputy Uganda Police Spokesman. He was speaking with reporter Peter Clotty from the capital, Kampala. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butty in Washington.
And I'm Odette Frazier. Today is Monday, March 10th. Please send your comments and opinions to Daybreak Africa at vonnews.com.
Daybreak Africa time is coming up at 17 minutes past the hour.
China may be Africa's biggest trading partner, but does that mean Chinese investors are reaping success from the deals? As Ricky Shryock reports in part 5 and final report in her series on China and Africa, on a large scale, many of the Chinese investors in Africa are being assisted by the Chinese government.
Trade between China and Africa totaled $200 billion in 2013. But who is benefiting from this business? Much of the increase comes from China's exports of raw materials from Africa. According to a recent report from Reuters, some 85% of China's exports from Africa are raw materials. Sven Grimm is the director of the Center for Chinese Studies at Stellenbosch University in South Africa. He says that as the Chinese government touts a program of the Chinese Dream, based on the idea of prosperity of both individuals and China itself, some Chinese are looking to realize their economic success in Africa. Grimm adds that when considering how successful these investments are, it's important to remember that larger companies often enjoy Chinese government subsidies when they invest in Africa.
It's an interesting question how successful Chinese investment is in general. There's quite a few researchers saying that the success rate of Chinese investment, also the large-scale one, is actually not that great.
The number of Chinese in Africa has increased over the last 20 years to an estimated 1 million people, according to Reuters. And Grimm is quick to add that not all of these Chinese investors have government help.
That clearly is not the case for small-scale investors.
One of these small-scale workers from China, San, is a shopkeeper in Dakar. He sells clothes and shoes imported from his home country. Business is not exactly booming, he says. There have been fewer clients in the past 2 years, he says, of business. The rent for the store is expensive. He adds that if business does not pick up, he might have to move back to China. San says, though, he would rather stay in Senegal, where he has lived and worked for 5 years. Although large-scale investment from China in Africa continues to grow, smaller businessmen such as San are less sure of their future on the continent. Ricky Shryock for VOA News, Dakar.
A spokesman for Nigerian President Goodluck Jonathan says the government will use the $458 million stolen by former head of state Sani Abacha and frozen by the U.S. government for infrastructure development in Nigeria. The U.S. Justice Department says last week the move to recover the money is the largest such action in its history. Presidential spokesman Ruben Abate tells me Nigeria and the United States have standing agreements in many areas, including the fight against terrorism and corruption.
The government of Nigeria has been very proactive, truly committed in ensuring that money that has been looted from the Nigerian treasury is returned to Nigeria. And the case of former head of state General Sani Abacha has quite a history to it. Money has been recovered, money laundered, money looted by General Abacha from other countries. Definitely the Nigerian government is interested in ensuring that the laundered money, the looted money, is returned to the treasury of Nigeria. The Ministry of Finance in Nigeria has always offered explanation and given account, due account, as to what has been done with the money that is returned. In Abacha's case, I think more than about $2 billion has already been recovered. And that money has been used for the development of infrastructure in various sectors of the economy, power, health, education, and other areas. So definitely, you know, this money coming back to Nigeria will be useful.
The U.S. State Department said that the corruption money was confiscated with help of the local authorities. So what I'm trying to find out is that did your government aggressively ask the United States to go after the stolen money of former Nigerian government officials?
Well, the thing to note that the Nigerian government has a standing cooperation agreement and collapse to the United States in many areas. Those critical areas include the fight against corruption, the fight against terrorism, and the promotion of human rights, social justice. So the United States, they have a very good, robust relationship in ensuring that issues are dealt with promptly in the interest of the majority of them, and that impunity of any sort, in whatever shape it presents itself, be it terrorism, insurgency, corruption, or criminality of any shape, is dealt with through bilateral cooperation.
Ruben Abate is the spokesman for Nigerian President Goodluck Jonathan. He was speaking with me from the capital, Abuja.
The Open Society Initiative for West Africa has released reports on Sierra Leone's governance, education and justice sectors. The country officer, Joe Pemagbi, tells me that citizens' engagement in the political process is very impressive and that the government has established policy reforms to boost that process.
Generally, I think it's been quite impressive because a lot of steps have been taken just to open up the space for that citizen state engagement. I think that space exists, and the fact that a critical ingredient for state-citizen partnership happens to be a dialogue. I think the government has also done quite a bit in terms of because they've been able to set up the Open Government Initiative, which is hosted by the Office of the President. But over and above that, I think institutions and processes are being, I mean, a lot of policy reforms have taken place in the last couple of years. I mean, one of those is the National Electoral Commission.
The report talks about political participation. What part does the local government play in overall political participation?
According to the Local Government Act, 2004 Local Government Act, a lot of power should have been devolved to the local government councils. I think that relationship in terms of strengthening the capacity, a lot of trainings have been conducted here and there, but I think a lot more needs to be done to ensure that you don't just create the structures without the capacity for them, for these structures to effectively implement their mandate. So it's a question of accountability, accountable governance, and that's where we still have a gap in the whole implementation and promotion of public participation in governance.
What were some of the noteworthy improvements in the justice sector?
A couple of things have happened recently. As a government, they've been able to pass a couple of legislations. One of them is the Local Court Act. We also have a Legal Aid Act, even though that is yet to be fully operationalized because we need a Legal Aid Board to help roll out that program. There's also an Independent Police Complaint Board. And now we have the three Gender Laws and Child Rights Acts that was also passed in 2007. And I must say the government, not that they've done quite a lot, but there is also the Judicial Code of Conduct, which also helps the government to keep tabs and keep, I mean, in terms of the judiciary, to provide the checks and balances for the folks in the judiciary.
Effective delivery of public education services is another report that was launched. Now, tell me about the current state of education in Sierra Leone.
There's a general concern all over the country that the standard of education has dropped, and it's worrying for parents, but even the society at large. And the Minister of Education, Science and Technology, they provide policies, plans and strategies to achieve their own mandate.
Joe Pemagbi is the country officer of the Open Society Initiative for West Africa, Sierra Leone. He was speaking with me from the capital of Freetown.
It's coming up at 25 minutes past the hour. Time now for Daybreak Africa Sports. And here is Mark Omar in Johannesburg, South Africa. A very good Monday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa Sports News, we begin with athletics. Ethiopian defending champion Mohamed Aman retained his 800-meter title at the World Indoor Championships in Sopot, Poland on Sunday. Kenyan Caleb Mwangangi Ndiku and Ethiopian Dejen Gebremeskel claimed the gold and bronze medals respectively in the men's 3,000 meters. In the women's version of the event, Ethiopian Genzebe Dibaba and Kenyan defending champion Helen Onsando Obiri made it a 1-2 African triumph, while Ivory Coast's Muriela Hore clinched a silver medal in the women's 60 meters in her second consecutive outing at this biannual event. Staying in Sopot, Ayanla Suleiman won the men's 1500 meters to hand Djibouti their first ever medal at a World Indoor Championships on Saturday. Ethiopian Aman Wote and Moroccan defending champion Abdelati Igida followed to secure an African medal podium sweep. Little-known Ethiopian Aksumawit Embai was a surprise women's 1500-meter silver medalist. Ethiopia finished third overall with 2 gold, 2 silver, and 1 bronze medal. Kenya is 10th, Djibouti 14th, Ivory Coast 24th, and Morocco 26th out of 27 countries on the medal table. Turning to volleyball, hosts Tunisia beat Congo Brazzaville by 3 straight sets as Seychelles dismissed Niger in a similar fashion on the final day at the Men's Africa World Volleyball Championship qualifiers in Tunis on Friday. Tunisia topped the log at the week-long round-robin contest with 12 points. Congo Brazzaville is second, followed by Seychelles, Niger and Senegal. Consequently, Tunisia joined Cameroon and Egypt in representing Africa at the Men's World Volleyball Championships due in Poland later this year. Finally, in football, hosts Lesotho and Swaziland played to a scoreless draw in a friendly in Maseru on Sunday. Earlier on Friday, Swaziland pipped their hosts by a solitary goal in their first encounter in the Lesotho capital. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Omar in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good day.
Here's our listener mail for this Monday morning, March 10th.
I wish to call on the Federal Republic of Nigeria to declare a 3-day compulsory national prayers and fasting by both Christians and the Muslims against the dreaded Boko Haram that terrorized the nation. And the God of the old Hebrews shall never leave the nation at threat. I am Prince John Ushie in Obaneku, Obodoluku government area, Cross River State, Nigeria.
Thank you, listener, for your comment. Please send your viewpoints to daybreakafrica@voanews.com.
And briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. Libyan militias in control of an eastern port are attempting to export oil from a North Korean flag tanker, despite a government ban prohibiting the militias from selling directly to the world market. Libyan Prime Minister Ali Zidane has threatened to bomb the tanker if it does not comply with Libyan government orders after leaving the port. Mr. Zidane said the bombing would result in an environmental disaster. Armed gunmen forced workers loyal to the government to dock the ship on Saturday. A militia spokesman has warned the government not to try to stop the shipment. There has been no immediate sign of the country's armed forces moving towards the port. That's it for this Monday, March 10th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for starting this week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Tracy Carter, reporters Peter Clutty and Ricky Stradock, as well as sports editor Mark Oman, along with all of our engineers, I'm James Butte, along with Odette Fraser in Washington, saying have a lovely day.
African Music Mix.
Are you wandering around lost in a musical desert? Well, follow your ears to the fantastic, the one and only African Music Mix on the Voice of America. Bathe yourself in this musical oasis. North to the south and from the east to the west, the African Music Mix plays only the best. Tune in from 0 to 300 hours UTC and from 11 to 1300 hours UTC every single day on The Voice of America. I'll be back.